Hello and welcome to 251, two pianists, five podcasts, one subject. My name's Nick Tomlin.
And I'm Simon Whiteside. And we're very honoured to say that this episode is sponsored by Open Studio, jazz lessons from jazz legends. Become a better jazz musician, guaranteed, at openstudiojazz.com. And more about that later. But in this episode, the final one in our series, we're going to be talking about Sonny Clark as a ballad player and looking at his legacy. So in this section, we're going to talk about three ballads recorded in 55, 56, and I think 57, respectively. You Go to My Head was recorded at the Macambo Club in Oakland in 1955. It was with Jerry Good on bass and Al Randall on drums. The tune is by Fred Coutts and Haven Gillespie, who also wrote and had a hit with Santa Claus Is Coming to Town. They play this tune at around 55 beats a minute. And Sonny Clark, at this time, and it's particularly noticeable, I think, on this album, as Nick has pointed out before, with Willow Weep for Me, he'll start his introductions in a more florid style, in what we call rubato or loose time, so not strict time. And there'll be quite a lot of sort of sixth chords and flourishes. And then when you get into the tune, it becomes a lot more influenced by bebop. We've said before that the sound quality on this is not the greatest, but they are longer recordings because I think it's probably recorded on tape either by the club owner or by an amateur. He does, therefore, not have the restrictions of trying to fit it onto the side of a record. He's not thinking about recording at all. Sometimes you don't even know you're being recorded in those situations. What are your thoughts, Nick?
Well, I think it is very noticeable on this track particularly that the intro is very much Art Tatum influenced, and it could almost be kind of Art Tatum. But then as soon as the bass and drums come in, he really starts playing bebop. So you can really hear it's, these two influences on his playing at this point, Art Tatum and Bud Powell. And I think later he manages to kind of integrate them a little bit more. But at this point, it's almost like, you know, there are these two influences and he's kind of figuring out how to use them, really.
To an outsider, I don't think, to someone who isn't particularly studying this, just listening to it, I think it hangs together stylistically. It's not like a black and white,
no.
Is it?
No.
But they are definitely, you can hear those flavours, and it does require, I think the biggest thing that makes the difference is articulation, because the swing pianist tends to be a bit more about lines and sort of almost like a legato approach. Whereas the bop players have got quite a lot of accents for a start and also short notes in comparison to making a more sustained sound. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah, yes, I think so. Although I would also sort of say that, Art Tatum was a big influence on the bebop players. There's a story that Charlie Parker took a job in a restaurant washing dishes, wasn't there, so that he could listen to Art Tatum play. And he very often mentioned Art Tatum as an influence. So it's not like these were two different, completely different influences. But it's interesting, I think, to hear the way that he's kind of juggling these different things at this time.
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard that Charlie Parker story, but I heard that it was Art Tatum who took a piano job to hear Bird wash up. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the person who I think that Art Tatum influence, and maybe Teddy Wilson also, shows up in strangely is Thelonious Monk, because he'll often, within his angular style, he'll often throw in these little runs which are pure, almost late 30s swing licks. And he was quite fascinated with sixth chords, wasn't he, particularly minor sixth chords. It always strikes me as sometimes if you edited out the angular bits, you might end up with a swing pianist with Monk.
Yeah, well, I think Thelonious Monk definitely comes from the swing era. That's where that's where his roots are, for sure.
Well, the next tune we're going to consider is from I Play Trombone, a Frank Rossolino album, and that was recorded in Los Angeles in 1956. It's got Frank Rossellino as the leader on trombone, obviously Sonny Clark on piano, Wilfred Middlebrooks on bass, and Stan Levy on drums. The tune Flamingo is by, I'm not quite sure how to say it, Gruya, I think, and Anderson, written in 1940. And it was a big hit for Herb Jeffries with Duke Ellington, and it was recorded in the December of 1940. The tune is taken, and we didn't mention, I'm not sure if we mentioned the speed of that You Go To My Head, but it, when it settles down, it's around about 55 beats a minute. And this is very slightly faster, 57 beats a minute. And the tune format of this is AABA, which means 2 8-bar sections the same, 1 8-bar section different, and a final 8-bar section the same as the original. Sonny does an introduction on this, as he often does on ballads, and there are some similarities with other introductions, but in some respects this one is slightly more interesting than some of the others around this period. And then eventually, after Frank's done his solo, playing on a muted trombone, cup mute is what Jeff Mason, a trombonist friend of mine, I couldn't quite work it out. It sounded like almost a solo tone mute, but not quite. But he thought after consideration it was a cup mute. Sonny Clark gets 2 A's before the tune comes back in.
Yeah, and I think what's noticeable listening to his solo for me is the way he's referencing the tune. So although in some ways it's quite a busy solo, he uses a lot of semiquaver runs and which he does in a lot of these ballad performances. He's sort of using the tune as a framework, and you can quite clearly hear the tune, and he sort of keeps coming back to the tune at various points in the improvisation. And I've noticed that's a real feature of his ballad improvising, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if this is anything to do with where he was at the time, but I've noticed, particularly, as you know, I've got an octet that plays the music of Dave Pell. A lot of the sax players at that time were more influenced by Lester Young than on the East Coast, where Charlie Parker was more of an influence. I mean, I think everyone was influenced by Charlie Parker. But I've noticed that in the charts, particularly when Dave Powell's solo section is coming up, the tune will be written out again over the changes for the blowing, so that he's got the shape of the melody to reference. I think Lester Young tended to, in a way, more extemporize off the melody than necessarily play on the chords, if that makes sense. Of course, they're playing within the chords. It's more a subtle thing, I think. But his Sonny solo seems to have quite a lot of double time figures, doesn't it? And he ends up quite often playing at the point in a tune where the rhythm section, sometimes just the drummer, and sometimes drummer and bass player, have gone into double time. Have you any further thoughts on this?
I think sometimes it's just a case of, I mean, I've noticed this as a piano player. Sometimes by the time you come in, you know, it's a ballad. It's very slow. Sometimes the saxophonist or trumpet player will take quite a sort of long, slow solo. So by the time you get to the piano solo, you sort of feel like you want to change gear a little bit and maybe, you know, maybe go into double time or just add a bit more energy to the performance. And that seems to be, I think that's probably why he tends to do these kind of quite busy, and also, I mean, very often he'll only get like 2 A's or sometimes just the bridge, you know, so yeah. He has to kind of fit in as much as he can, really, I suppose, in that short space.
The thing about a saxophone or a trumpet is you're blowing it and you've got the opportunity to change tone and do a lot of longer notes. Piano, obviously being a percussion instrument, that dies away much more quickly. So you can play sustained, but it's not in. You can't, once you've hit a note, you can't do anything with it, can you?
No.
So perhaps that's another reason that piano players tend to play a little faster in ballads, just because of the pure sustaining quality or lack of sustaining quality. Well, the final tune we're going to think about in this section is Sophisticated Lady, and that comes from an album called Cliffcraft, doesn't it?
Yeah, so this is a Clifford Jordan album, and this is an album he recorded when he was in New York for the Blue Note label, and the session was November the 10th, 1957, and the rest of the band were George Tucker on bass and Lewis Hayes on drums.
Yeah, and this tune, Sophisticated Lady, is by Duke Ellington. And as with many of his tunes, it comes from bits that other people in his band had sort of generated. So Lawrence Brown wrote the A section theme, and Otto Hardwick kind of wrote the B section theme. And often Ellington would pay people off for their themes and then orchestrate it and arrange it and add extra sections, for example. And they do this as the slowest one so far at 50 beats per minute. It's quite a hard tune to play, and Ted Gioia points out that it's quite often people have difficulty soloing on this because of the nature of the fast-moving chords. And in fact, pianist Lou Levy summed up the challenges in his mock toast. Here's to all the guys who died coming out of the bridge of Sophisticated Lady. But interestingly, I think Sonny's playing on this. He's probably the most fluid of the soloists on it. He doesn't get stuck in repetitive licks over the... because it's got a lot of what we call sequences in music, hasn't it, where you have the same thing moving down in steps.
Yeah, and I noticed here that they kind of... I think the original change is it's really just descending dominant chords, isn't it? But here they put in these kind of very quick sort of 2-5-1 changes, which kind of makes the whole thing even even harder to sort of negotiate.
Even
really.
Busier.
Yeah.
Well, Sonny gets to start the tune, and this is another situation, as we've discussed before. He uses his something which might be said to be similar to a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. That and often in thirds he does that lick, and I think he does it in thirds on this one. You have mentioned before that you think, in some respects, he's got a set of things he does on ballad introductions.
I mean, I think as a pianist, you very often the frontline player will say, right, okay, give me 8 bars in, and that's it, and then you have to kind of come up with 8 bars, which leads into the top of the tune. So I think very often pianists have a kind of repertoire of, I mean, I suppose I have to an extent, you know, you've got a repertoire of intros that lead into a particular situation, you know. So I think that's what he's doing here, seems to be.
Well, we're going to discuss some ballads in a bit more detail in the next section, and we're going to start with I'll Remember April.
The next track we're going to talk about is I'll Remember April, which is from the Sonny Clark Trio album recorded on October the 13th, 1957, for Blue Note. The other musicians on this session were Paul Chambers on bass and Philly Joe Jones on drums, although they're not actually on this track as it's a solo piano performance. Sonny Clark plays it as a ballad, which is unusual, as most of the jazz versions of this are done either kind of medium swing or fast, and even sometimes with a Latin A section. But Sonny Clark plays it slow, and I think probably it was originally written as a ballad. A lot of these show tunes were originally written as ballads. So the intro is kind of interesting. He uses these chordal voicings. So he's going from E flat major to A flat major. Now the key of the tune is G major, so he's quite a long way away from the actual tonic or the key. So it creates this quite sort of ambiguous. You don't quite know where he is. He's going from E flat major to A flat major, and he's using these chordal voicings. Now a chordal voicing is just a voicing which uses fourths rather than thirds. In traditional harmony, chords are built of third intervals. But a lot of musicians around this time were experimenting with these chordal sounds, these fourth intervals. And this also ties in with the interest in modal jazz, which was kind of happening around this time. So let's have a listen to the intro, the first sort of two chords of I'll Remember April. The next extract we're going to listen to is an example of him moving from a one chord in this case G major, to F7, or the flat 7 chord. So let's just listen to that, and then I'll talk about it afterwards. So here what he's doing, he's basically landing on a G major chord, which is the tonic, but then on the second beat he moves to an F7 chord and sort of reharmonizes the melody, which is a B, with an F7 chord, which creates a nice sense of kind of instability, because he's resolved the chord, but then immediately he moves away from the chord. And this is something he does quite a lot in this performance. And in fact, the next example is very similar, because here also he's... this happens at the end of the head. So after he's played the whole head, he then goes into this little section where he's alternating between an F7 chord and a G major chord. And again, it creates this nice sort of sense of ambiguity about where the tonic is. And it's quite interesting. Let's have a listen to this next example.
Yeah, that was an element of the tune that caught my ear as well. It reminds me a bit of the way Thelonious Monk will, in his own tunes, sometimes get caught up with a phrase that he really likes. He almost repeats it and repeats it and repeats it, just thinking about it, and gets you to consider it. So I'm not sure if it's a direct influence, but certainly that's what it reminded me of. So what else have you pulled out of this tune, Nick?
The next example comes from the end of the tune. So what he does, he sort of goes to the dominant. So he goes to the D7 chord, which would normally lead to the G major. But at that point, he does this kind of extended cadence where he keeps moving to these different sections and kind of constantly sort of delaying the final resolution, which is quite nice. And one thing he does, he uses this sort of very common melody, which you hear quite a lot. And in fact, Tad Dameron actually made it part of his tune, If You Could See Me Now. But it also crops up in Miles Davis's 4. And it's a little melodic idea which he uses. So we'll have a listen to that now. From this, he moves into a series of descending, diminished voicings. And it's quite dissonant voicing. So he's playing a D-flat triad over a D note, and then a B-flat triad over a B note. And these sounds, I tend to associate them more with later piano players like Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea, who really use these sounds, these kind of diminished, quite dissonant diminished chords. And after this, he then moves into another sort of cadence point. So he goes to a dominant seventh. But instead of resolving, he moves back into these A-flat major chord to E-flat major chord, the chords he was using in the intro. So he's kind of referring back to the intro. So he's obviously thinking in quite a structural way here.
Yeah, I mean, I think his use of diminished has developed more towards the end of his career. Of course, he's got that pattern at the end of Minor Move, which is a fairly, it's a tune he wrote in sort of, well, we don't know exactly when he wrote it, but that first recording was before he moved to New York, so before 57.
Mm.
And I think when he is in New York, he's changing his harmonic language, developing more and starting to pick up diminished shapes and playing scales, etc. And it gives a sort of almost Debussy-like coda, doesn't it, to this piece?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a connection, I think, with the sort of Impressionism, and obviously Bill Evans drew a lot on composers like Debussy and Ravel, and you can hear it in this arrangement, I think, the way that he's using these sounds, not so much in a functional way, but in a more sort of impressionistic sort of, he's interested in the sounds these chords make rather than necessarily their function. And I think it creates a nice kind of feeling of, like I say, ambiguity. You're not quite sure how it's going to resolve and where it's going to resolve, which makes the whole thing quite satisfying.
I've always thought that Sonny Clark's a thinking pianist, and perhaps the sort of vagueness is the reference to the fact that it's I'll Remember April. It's not a song about April now. It's about a remembered April. Mm. And perhaps it's that sort of evocation of almost the, you know, the wavy lines you get in film, in the old cliche of going back in time.
Mm. Mm.
So it is a really nice arrangement. And I think also it's quite modern sounding, very, very different to the Macambo Club sort of Tatum-y versions of things like Willow Weep For Me that you've already pointed out.
Mm. Although he does use these runs, you know, which kind of these sort of he still plays in this sort of slightly swing style, but like you say, with much more modern chords and more progressive harmony. And
well, I think the scales are different, though. I don't hear that reliance on the major sixth chord.
No, that's true.
The swing pianists use.
That's true. Yeah.
So although the gestures are similar, I don't think the language is quite the same.
No.
We're going to go on to talk about Sonny Clark playing ballads in an ensemble setting now, and we're going to focus on three ballads that he recorded with Dexter Gordon.
The next track we're going to look at is I Guess I'll Hang My Tears Out to Dry from the classic Dexter Gordon Go album, which was recorded at the new Van Gelder Studios in Englewood Cliffs in August of 1962. And the band on this recording was obviously Dexter Gordon on tenor sax, Sonny Clark on piano, Billy Higgins on drums and Butch Warren on bass. And Billy Higgins and Butch Warren had already appeared on Sonny Clark's Leaping and Loping album from 1961.
The tune Guess I'll Hang My Tears Out to Dry is a 1944 torch song, and it's obviously become a jazz standard. Music by Jewel Stein and lyrics by Sammy Kahn. It was introduced on stage by the film star Jane Withers in the show Glad to See You, which closed in Boston and never opened on Broadway. So obviously the song did a lot better than the show. Stein and Kahn had previously written songs for several of her films, so there's a working relationship there on that. I think this is probably one of my Desert Island Discs, this tune. Dexter Gordon's playing on it is magnificent. It's got a fantastic introduction, which in this case, the whole band, I think it is the whole band play it. You know, so it's not a piano introduction. It's a verse, basically, isn't it, that they play?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they play the verse.
And there's that brilliant end of the verse. There's that brilliant sort of scale rising up from Dexter Gordon, which is almost like a film cue, that sort of build of excitement of into the head. It's brilliantly... It's a ballad, but it's also kind of epic, in my opinion. It's got a real weight to it. A fantastic vehicle for Dexter Gordon to blow on. Sonny Clark doesn't get much chance on it because he only ends up playing on eight bars, but it is pretty slow, so he gets a few licks away, as it were. And I've mocked up this for the solo section for us. We'll listen to that now. And I think it's pretty clear from the end of that solo where Sonny Clark uses block chords to reintroduce where Dexter Gordon's about to come in back on the tune for the last A. The sort of power that it sort of drops down really on Sonny Clark's solo, and he builds it back up for that powerful tone of Dexter Gordon to come in. He's got some nice little uses of B flat chord, then it goes to a B minor sort of nine type chord. And it's really interesting how he approaches that with which notes he chooses to play. But he it's quite fluid. I think it's also It's interesting when you're trying to take these things down. We haven't got transcriptions written down of this, but they're really hard to notate because the flexibility over the rhythm that he's exploring is almost unnotatable, really, in some respects. You have to sort of make a guess at it or write something down that can be read musically but then played along with the recording in order to get the actual feeling of the time. Did you find that in transcribing other ballads?
Yeah, it's always tricky with ballads, isn't it? Because, as you say, everything's so much slower, so there's so much more space for kind of pulling around the time and the beat. And yeah, I find it always difficult, particularly on ballads, how to notate, especially the rhythmic notation, isn't it? How do you actually notate it rhythmically?
Yeah, it's the note values become very short and everything kind of looks like a cadenza. When you look, same trying to read an Art Tatum transcription, it looks impossible to play. But when you play along with a recording of it, it starts to become a bit clearer what the gestures are. Well, the one other album that was recorded very... So they had basically Dexter Gordon was in New York and they did some concerts and then they recorded these two albums. So everything was fairly concise. And I think the fact that they've been doing some gigs with this stuff probably helped a lot in terms of why it sounds so cohesive and really well together. And I think the album sleeve notes on both the albums, people talk about going to hear those concerts and how Dexter Gordon was sort of welcomed back to New York with a, you know, almost a sort of star status, really. And that lots of people turned out for those gigs. And we're going to talk about Don't Explain and Until the Real Thing Comes Along, which comes from the second album, A Swinging Affair.
The recording session for A Swinging Affair happened only 2 days after the Go session that we spoke about before. So the Swinging Affair was recorded on August the 29th, 1962, and the Go session was August the 27th, 1962. And we're going to focus on one of the tracks they recorded at the Swinging Affair session, and that's Don't Explain.
Yes, Don't Explain is a Billie Holiday tune that was written in 1944. In her 1956 autobiography, Holiday cites the infidelity of her first husband, Jimmy Monroe, as the inspiration for this song. Specifically, an instance in which Monroe's woeful attempt to explain away lipstick on his collar elicits Holiday's disgusted response, "Take a bath, man, don't explain." Now, that's a direct quote from a brilliant book by the jazz author Ted Gioia, and it's called The Jazz Standards. And it's a really interesting book if you listen to a lot of jazz, because it covers, obviously not every song in the book, but covers a lot of the big tunes and gives information on who wrote them, when they were composed, what they come from, and usually some little bit of background and biographical information and some famous recordings worth listening to. So that's one I would highly recommend. In fact, all of Ted Gioia's books on jazz are very, very good, I think. Don't Explain, Sonny's intro. What do you have to say about that, Nick?
Yeah, I transcribed the intro that Sonny plays on this tune. And we're going to listen to the first four bars of the intro, where he uses what we call in jazz upper structure triads. It's basically where you use a triad over a chord. So in the first example here, he plays a D7 chord, and in his right hand he kind of outlines a B major chord. And he does that also with the next chord, which is G7, and he uses an A triad over that. So let's have a listen to this first example. So in this tune, Sonny Clark solos over the bridge section, again, as in a lot of examples where he's playing with a frontline player. He doesn't always get to solo over the whole form. And in bar six of the transcription, which we'll put up onto our Patreon site, in bar six, he does this again. So he plays a B flat 7 chord, but over the top he's using a, it's really a C major arpeggio over the B flat 7 chord. So let's have a listen to that example. And in bars 10 to 12 of this transcription, he plays quite a long double time phrase. A lot of this solo is taken up with him playing semiquavers. And this is really interesting because what he does here is he kind of delays the resolution of the line. So he's playing over a 5-1 progression here, but rather than resolving it where he hits the one chord, which is what you would naturally do, he kind of delays the resolution by a beat. And it creates this sort of sense, again, of forward motion. I think this is another way that he creates his sense of forward motion. So let's have a listen to that example now.
Now, that's all very interesting stuff. I think the upper structure thing is something which comes into his playing again. It's a New York years addition to his playing. And I think that what it's about, we talked about this off air earlier, about thinking about ways of looking at music and getting the concept solidified in your mind for improvising. I think upper structure techniques are really great for voicings particularly, but they're also really good ways of making the chord sound different. So you've got a C7 in the left hand, and if you play that a D triad in the right hand, you get a C7 sharp 11 sound. And then you can choose other triads which make different qualities, but the left-hand part stays the same. And what the first example you gave, for example, that sort of creates a flat 9 type sound, doesn't it? Well, brilliant. We'll go on to talk now about the other ballad on the Swinging Affair album. It's not very often that you get two ballads on an album, is it?
No, it's unusual really to record two.
And I think that may be partly why they treat it slightly differently as well. So I have mocked up the introduction, which we'll listen to now. And you can hear how different that is from Don't Explain. It's got a much more florid affair. And I think also it's got that thing I've been describing as his sax lick, that bail-you-doo, bail-you-doo, bail-you-doo. He's certainly more florid, but he's not going Teddy Wilson on us. He's not going back to Art Tatum. It is his mature version of that, I suppose you'd call it. And he continues that, particularly that sort of running sax lick thing in the comping behind Dexter Gordon as he's playing the tune. Now, Sonny gets a little bit more of a solo in this tune. He gets two A's before they come back in on the bridge, which is a common ballad technique, so that you don't end up playing the whole of the tune at the end of the piece. And I've transcribed and recorded the first of those two A's, well, in fact, just slightly into the next A, because he does his sax lick thing again there. Let's have a listen to that. Once again, we've got lots of very short note values and lots of runs, but I think it is a different feel and a different type of solo to on Don't Explain. Do you have any thoughts on that, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, it's notable on this track, I think, as you said. He's a lot busier in his comping and in the solo, really. So it seems like it was a deliberate sort of tactic on his part for some reason, like you say, maybe because it was the second ballad, or they wanted to slightly change the feel of the ballad or something. But it is definitely noticeable on this.
One of the things I noticed from the Buddy DeFranco days is that they did play tunes which you might call a ballad, although they were always around 70 beats per minute, so a slightly fast ballad, almost approaching slow swing. But they were very, very similar. And in fact, I noticed in the discography that they actually recorded ballads next to each other. So they had the slight problem of the fact that they've just finished a ballad and they were going to record another one, and it is almost identical tempo, really, and feel. I think in this particular case, they've done a good service to the tune by treating it slightly differently.
Mm. Yeah, I would also like to just say I love the way that Dexter comes back in after Sonny Clark's solo, and he just kind of he just launches into Summer Over the Rainbow and it's a great. I love the way that, you know, Dexter Gordon, when he does a quote, you know, some people try and slip the quotes in very subtly, but in this case it's just very obvious, you know, he just kind of blasts it out, and it's brilliant. It's a brilliant I love the way he kind of re-enters the tune.
For me, Dexter Gordon and quotes are synonymous. And sometimes I wonder whether they're musical or extra musical. For example, you know, it's said that when Charlie Parker was playing in a 52nd Street club, if some sailors come in to the club, he might pay, because, you know, that the end of that street was basically straight onto the docks, wasn't it?
Mm.
And so they'd often get visiting ships docking and sailors coming off for their jolly in New York, and he'd play like the sailor's hornpipe or something. I know that Dexter Gordon in a live gig would sometimes do that, but he actually plays a Christmas quote of chestnuts roasting on an open fire, doesn't he, in one of these albums. My first thought was, I wonder if they recorded it around Christmas, but we know that they didn't. So I don't know whether perhaps he thought it was going to be released in December. Who knows? But you're right. He does. And he also manages to, because it doesn't quite fit Somewhere Over the Rainbow here, does it? So he has to.
Yeah. He has to adapt it slightly.
When he continues on with the tune, as it were, he adapts it to the changes that are happening.
Yeah.
And he does seem to like these quotes that have the big leap, like Chestnuts and Over the Rainbow.
Yeah.
Anyway, that concludes our looking at him as a ballad player, and we're going to finish our series. Can't believe the first series is already over, Nick. Mm-hmm. It only seems like 10 weeks ago we started. Oh, hang on. yes, we're going to assess our feelings of what we have learnt from studying Sonny Clark in more detail, and we're going to have a look at what legacy has been left by him. Before we conclude our five-part podcast series on the pianist Sonny Clark, I'd like to say a few words about our sponsor today, Open Studio. Open Studio is an online jazz resource, and it covers all the main instruments that play jazz that you would expect: trumpet and saxophone, bass, piano, guitar, etc., including some of really great performers who teach on this platform. The vocal coach, for example, is Diane Reeves. The bass tutor, or one of them, is Christian McBride. And there is also a Latin jazz section. The guitarist Romero Lobambo has several courses on bossa nova, for example, and Brazilian guitar. It's a really fantastic way of becoming a better player. I've got the piano access pass, which is from beginner to advanced. And it's a great resource for me. Even though I've been playing jazz professionally since the 1980s, I have indeed improved, as the strapline says, become a better player, guaranteed. The course I'm particularly enjoying at the moment is Adam Manus's Daily Guided Practice. It's about a 20 to 30 minute daily session weekdays. And it gives you the opportunity to focus your practice in ways you may not have chosen to if you did it yourself. For example, we've taken a bebop lick through all the keys. We've been doing some five-note voicings recently and coming up with a way of harmonizing melody notes. Also, there's technical practice and lots of really useful things. And it means that you will practice at least for 30 minutes a day. If you're like me, I'm a musician who works in film and TV and scoring, arranging, those sorts of things. It's a little easy to let the jazz piano go onto the back burner and even slip. So I found that particular daily guided practice thing fantastic. And it's worth noting that that didn't exist on the piano course when I joined up. So if you get one of these access passes, you get all future courses that go into your particular area. So I recommend highly going over to openstudiojazz.com and seeing what's on offer. They have got some great deals during the coronavirus pandemic, which we've all been suffering recently. Anyway, back to Sonny Clark and his legacy and what we've learnt from him.
Before we finish off this series and maybe talk a little bit about what we've taken away from it, what we've learnt from it, it might be worth mentioning some of the Sonny Clark tributes that musicians have put out since his death. One of these was the saxophonist John Zorn, who's a kind of New York saxophonist, really more associated with the free jazz scene, I would say. But in 1986, he recorded an album of Sonny Clark tunes called Voodoo, with a band that included Wayne Horvitz on piano, Ray Drummond on bass, and Bobby Previte on drums. I think actually it was Wayne Horvitz who put the band together. It was his project, really. He said that he and Zorn had actually been playing Clark tunes since the 70s. And in fact, although John Zorn is better known as a kind of free player in the kind of Ornette Coleman mold, he's very interested in the kind of jazz lineage and bebop. And in fact, Horvitz also said that John Zorn used to just practice bebop all the while. That was his main sort of focus, really, even though you wouldn't necessarily know it from his recordings. And it's quite an interesting album. I mean, for me personally, I think the tune Voodoo works best, really. I think that really worked as a vehicle for a slightly more sort of free approach. Although having said that, I mean, the other thing that's quite odd in a way is how conventional it is, considering the musicians, and it's quite conventional. I mean, the band are playing swing, really, and John Zorn, he does play in a more kind of, I'd say, Ornette Coleman,
yeah,
sort of style. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, Simon.
I agree with what you said. I mean, John Zorn has occasional moments of free gesturing, but mostly he's playing, you know, more conventionally within the style, and I think they do play the tunes as they were intended, if you like,
yeah,
as Sonny Clark played them. And I like that. I like the fact that they're sort of respecting that. Wayne Horvitz does occasionally go off on slightly more progressive sort of tangents when he's in his soloing as well. But generally speaking, you'd call it a straight-ahead album, I think.
It is essentially.
I mean, I've got some John Zorn records which I occasionally listen to, but I have to say, when I'm feeling in a particular, I'd like to listen to something a bit more out there. And this is quite conventional in comparison to that and to his normal output, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I do like the tune Nicely, which comes from a Jackie McLean album called Tipping the Scales. And in fact, I noticed when I looked at the track listing that Sonny Clark wrote out of six of those tunes. So they do Nursery Blues Nicely and Two for One on that album. And I suppose McLean being an alto player and John Zorn playing alto on this is a link, perhaps. I don't know. Did you have any further thoughts on that, or should we talk about the John Hicks project?
The piano player John Hicks, who was sort of a contemporary of Sonny Clark. I mean, he knew Sonny Clark anyway. I think he was obviously much younger than Sonny Clark. But they did actually meet, I think, didn't they? Or yeah, he knew Sonny Clark.
I think he was 10 years younger than him.
Mm-hmm. And so a few years ago, he brought out an album called Music in the Key of Clark. And this was a trio recording, and it was part of a series of recordings that he'd made, sort of saluting musicians from Pittsburgh. As we mentioned in, I think, in the first episode, there are a lot of really prominent musicians actually came from Pittsburgh, particularly pianists, strangely enough. So other musicians in this series of albums he brought out were Mary Lou Williams, Errol Garner, Billy Strayhorn, Earl Hines, and the Sonny Clark album was a kind of, was part of this series, basically. And I really like this album, actually. It's great. It's more conventional than the John Zorn tribute. But it's very kind of respectful. And although, having said that, I mean, he does change some of the tunes. So Minor Mood, he plays it with a kind of a funk groove, doesn't he? And he also slightly changes the chords. He turns it into more of a blues.
Solo on a blues on it, don't they?
Yeah.
Which is interesting in a way. And I think also my conception, they play in 3-4, which makes it sound even more like Waltz for Debbie.
Yeah, it does. It does actually on this. It does sound quite a lot like Waltz for Debbie.
But he chooses some... So the Sonny Clark originals that he plays are My Conception, Cable Car, Minor Meeting, Sonny's Mood, Sonny's Crib... but the rest are sort of tributes, aren't they, rather than...
Yeah, they're tunes by him, kind of, sort of named for Sonny Clark or inspired by Sonny Clark, or I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's one called Clark Bar Blues. I wasn't quite sure whether that was some Clark bars or not rethought. But, yeah, the playing's lovely on it, and he's one of those players who did his time with lots of different bands, and I think he played for Betty Carter, didn't he? And
yeah,
different people over time. And he's a really solid, not a pianist I'd particularly come across before, if I'm honest. Which just goes to show you how many great players there are out there who you don't know about, really.
Yeah.
I like this a lot, actually. Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say that you discovered another tribute which I hadn't really come across.
Oh, yes, this one is slightly left field. It's it's a band called Jazz Tech. And look, I think they've got extra Zs and Tech spelt with no C. Which, they come under, certainly Apple Music classes them as techno. Although I think some of these labels get a bit blurred. But it's definitely electronica. And, yeah, they've got various jazz artists who they are calling, well, there's four tracks called Replicant Clark, Replicant Sonny Clark. Yeah, and it's quite weird, actually, to be honest. not particularly easy to spot the... It's not, you know, they're not taking samples of Sonny Clark and playing them.
Mm.
So it's a different... you can hear bits and pieces in there. It's worth checking out if you've got one of those streaming programs, I guess.
Mm. And it's interesting that, you know, these musicians from different fields, you know, sort of electronic music and you know, John Zorn is kind of free jazz. You know, they obviously found something in Sonny Clark that appealed to them, and, you know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Sonny Clark seems to be one of those people who... every so often gets a bit of a dusting off and a re-look at. And in the time that we've been doing this podcast, which is, you know, a 10-week period from when we started, I think, I have noticed there have been a few more articles about Sonny Clark coming up in my searches for background data.
Mm.
So maybe it's a, you know, like the record going round, we've got to the bit of the record where there's that little scratch which says, "Oh, think about Sonny Clark."
Mm, mm.
So we need to talk about what we have gained from studying Sonny Clark in more detail. Do you have any opening thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a few licks that I definitely need to learn, apart from anything else. You know, some good phrases that I've picked up from the transcriptions. But I think more generally, I mean, things that, you know, I've thought about. I mean, I'm constantly impressed with his consistency, really. That's the thing. Listening to, you know, I've listened to hours and hours now, as you have, of Sonny Clark, and he's just so consistent. I mean, considering as well the kind of difficult and I guess slightly chaotic sort of personal life that he had. I mean,
yeah,
you know, to have that consistency and to always play, you know, well, solidly and musically is no mean feat, really, is it? I don't think.
No, I mean, I've got a. We knew when we went into this, because we've both done some transcriptions already, that he had a lot to offer. But I think for me, what I've come away with is that he's got, he's particularly his swing and faster is really interesting to me, how he is quite economic with his lines.
Mm.
And as he goes on through his career, he really starts to develop ideas almost symphonically. I think something you picked up as well, that little phrases that sort of have internal logic and then keep growing. And he's very solid line man, if you know, if that makes sense. And some pianists, as we've said in other episodes, they can be very impressive. They can be playing stuff that is rhythmically very difficult. And I think one of the big things that we haven't talked a lot about the similarities between him and Bill Evans, although we've talked about how they liked each other's playing. But I think the only other player who I can think of who's as melodic and developmental that I listen to a lot is Bill Evans. And that's a similarity, although their actual style is different. You know, Bill Evans being much more about triplets than Sonny Clarke is, I think. And also a bit more about sort of chordal, that thing where he'll play a chord repeatedly in the left hand in rhythmic unison with a line in the right hand, which Sonny Clarke rarely does. But yeah, the fact that it's so melodic and joined up, and in a way, it doesn't sound learnt either, does it? It's not.
No, I think that's the thing. You always get the sense that he's really improvising. That he's really, you know. Again, with some players, you sort of get the sense that they're improvising, but it's very much kind of vocabulary that they've learnt and that they're sort of putting together. But and although obviously Sonny Clarke has licks and phrases, but you always get the sense that he's trying to kind of come up with something new, that he's trying to kind of develop a line, and you know, I really get that sense with him.
It feels natural, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, the idea of improvisation, I suppose, certainly from my perspective, is you want to give the impression that you're making it up on the spot, and that you don't want the mechanics of your long hours of practice. And, you know, for example, there's that one lick that I've identified in the middle of Minor Mood. Was it Minor Mood? Or yes, I think it was. That you said you thought came from Charlie Parker's Steeplechase. Now, that lick, in isolation, I've learnt that myself now, and I'm taking it through the keys to make it fluid. But to start with, that's going to sound like a lick to people listening. If they're very knowledgeable about jazz, they're going to think, oh, yeah, that's a lick. But one hopes that in a longer period of time, it will become integrated to your playing so much that you're not really playing that lick, but something from, you know, an element of that lick.
Yeah, because part of your vocabulary, really.
And it's a word, it's a new word, isn't it, to throw into your speaking.
Yeah.
And one of the things I've always, when people ask me what is improvisation, I've always explained it by saying, if you go to hear, go to watch a play, there's a text that's written down, and the actor's job is to interpret that text and make you understand it and bring something of themselves to it. And that's a bit like classical music. There's a text and an interpretation of that text. Whereas with jazz, I think it's more like giving a speech or, talking in Parliament maybe, or in a debate.
Yeah, it's an impromptu speech.
But you do have... You can only do that well if you've practiced how to do it a lot.
If you're prepared, yeah.
And also, if you've got points to make, you might not make them in the same order, and you might not make them exactly the same. So someone might interject something which you find interesting, and you go off on a slightly different tangent. And I think that's really how Sonny Clarke improvises. You can hear him responding to the band, especially with people like Philly Joe Jones on drums.
Mm.
You can hear some stuff being thrown between the two of them
quite
easily. And also with his frontline players, you hear elements of that. And I suppose with his ballad playing, what I've discovered is that there is a lot more fluidity in his playing during ballad solos. And he's not, when he's playing swing, it's quite quavers and triplets, isn't it, with the occasional semi-quaver. But in ballads, it's a far more variety of articulation and note length and groupings. And, you know, sometimes there's a seven in there and a five and things like that. And it's not really, he's hitting the beats, but he's not, the subdivisions of those beats are much more varied. What would you agree with that? And do you have anything to add on ballads?
No. I think you're right. I mean the sort of sense of time becomes freer, I think, on the ballads. Although I'm not sure that's not necessarily specifically Sonny Clark, is it? But again, you sort of hear. I mean, his sense of time is really remarkable, I think, and. Because it's actually quite hard to do that. I think it's very hard to play freely around the time, but like you say, sort of hit the beats and he does it. It just sounds effortless when he does it, you know. And it's not easy to do that.
Well, certainly for me, the hardest thing, something I'd like to assimilate from his playing, but the hardest thing for me to assimilate will be his feel and trying to get that lightness of touch and bounce that he seems to manage to have. And it's something I also identify in, say, the playing of Wynton Kelly. There's a sort of snappiness and a lovely rhythmic bounce to their playing.
I mean, I think another thing which that really impresses me with his playing, having listened to a lot of it, is just also how kind of generous he is as a player. You know, you always feel that he's kind of working to make the group sound good. And also, as you've mentioned before, you know, he's trying to adapt to the playing situation. You really get a sense that he's, you know, he's thinking, how can I best sort of serve this particular situation, you know, depending on the musicians he's playing with and the lineup and whatever. Without, you know, he still sounds like Sonny Clark, but he's really thinking about, you know, what his role is. That's the way I sort of hear it.
No, I agree with that. And I think that he does react well to, I mean, that's, I think, why his, I mean, obviously got older and more experienced. And as we know, we learn something new all the time about jazz as we progress through our playing careers. But I think his move to New York changed his playing more at that point than the first sort of 7 or so years that he was on the West Coast playing with different people. I think he said so himself, didn't he, in one of those liner notes that you read out, that there were more people around to listen to and to get your head around. Perhaps that sort of more spread outness of California and the way in which it's laid out just means that you're not rubbing shoulders with people quite as much as you do in a city like New York or, you know, Chicago and other places where there's a scene going on, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, apart from to say that I think his left hand does clearly develop over time, particularly as he plays in his later trio albums, I think that's probably all of the main points that I've got to take away. Have you got anything to add?
No, not really. I mean, I agree with what you said about, you know, I get a sense with him that in fact he says himself, doesn't he, that he was always looking to develop and progress and take on new ideas. And I mean, it's interesting, when I did the transcription of the I Remember April, I was quite impressed with how progressive a lot of it was, you know, the harmonically. You know, he was obviously, like you say, absorbing influences and sort of working on new sounds. And I think you're right. And I agree that his playing after the move to New York, I think it changed. And And again, it's a tragedy, really, that he was kind of cut off, really, in his prime, and it would have been interesting to see how he would have developed.
I think if we'd been lucky enough to have five more years of him, we could have heard some really great stuff. Because it seemed to me that last album that he made as a leader, Leaping and Loping, he started to have much more control over his compositions and much more of an idea of what made a good album. It wasn't just writing a tune. I think it felt like an ensemble of tunes that went together to make a good album. And also he was starting to investigate more progressive structures and perhaps starting to play notes that he hadn't included in his vocabulary before, slightly outside of the chords, or at least more dissonant. So I feel it's a great shame that he didn't have more time to give us more music. Well, I think we'll wrap up our opinions there on the overall growth of Sonny Clark over time and what we've learnt. And we've just got a few little things to say in a minute about where we go next.
We're planning on doing another series of these podcasts starting in August, and we thought it might be fun to ask you, the listeners, to decide who we talk about. One of our ideas with these series of podcasts is to look at pianists who are maybe a little bit under the radar and who kind of get overlooked a little bit. So we picked three sort of lesser known piano players, Kenny Drew, Elmo Hope, and Ray Bryant. And we've put together a little survey, which you can find on our Facebook page. And you simply just click through, and there's a survey. You just choose the person who you'd like us to talk about, and that's it. It's quite a simple process, really. And then once we're going to leave this open for another week or so, and then once we've collected all the responses, we'll decide, well, obviously based on those responses, who we're going to do for our next series. Please check out our Facebook page. And we're also going to be looking to do an ebook in December, aren't we, Simon?
Yes. I mean, one of the things we wanted to do was to make some permanent record of what we've learnt from Sonny Clark. And we've taken down solos. We've got some other solos that we haven't yet released on our Patreon page, etc. And also some analysis of his albums, etc. So it'll be a reasonable size book, although not a massive project. It will be aimed more at people interested in playing his music, I guess, than a straightforward biography, although of course we'll include the limited biographical information that is available. And keep an eye out for that. And of course, if you're one of our Patreon supporters, that's part of the certain tier and above. You get the ebook as part of your monthly donation. The other thing we would like to do, although at the moment we're slightly hampered by the lockdown in London, is a video on how to play like Sonny Clark. And we're hoping to do that in the same place, get into the same place. So we've done this entire podcast remotely. Nick's in East London and I'm in West London. So we've been doing it via the interwebs. And eventually we will produce that video, hopefully in the not too distant future. We've got some thanks to meet out. First of all, obviously, for this episode, to our sponsor Open Studio, but also some people helped us in promoting the podcast. I think you'd like to mention a few of those, Nick.
Yeah, there were some online blogs, London Jazz News, Bebop Spoken Here, and The Jazz Man. They're all sort of jazz blogs which report on the jazz scene in the UK, different parts of the UK. And all of those featured the podcast, so we'd like to thank those for doing that.
And there's some musicians who we spoke to on more specific subjects. So I had a long conversation with Mark Crooks about the clarinet and Buddy DeFranco, and Matt Fishwick. We had a nice long conversation about lots of things to do with Blue Note, but particularly the drummers, that Sonny Clark played with. More recently, Jeff Mason lent me his trombone knowledge. Well, we spoke about the Frank Rossellino album. I know Frank Rossellino is one of his favourite players. And we've also got some very engaged listeners we'd like to thank.
Yeah, so there's a couple of guitarists who have been very supportive and sent me some really nice comments about the podcast. So that's Elton Motley and Ian Wheeler, who've both given really nice reviews of the series.
We've got our mutual bass playing friend Dominic Howells, who's kept us honest throughout this five podcast series, and also he's been transcribing in lockdown. He's been transcribing some Sonny Clark stuff himself and learning about certain tunes, and particularly off the Trio album, I think. And then there's a someone we've both played with me many years ago when I was down in Bath, Duncan Anselm, who has been transcribing a few heads from various albums. And we'd like to thank those who have offered us encouragement. Most recently, Rich Capeless, who is a fantastic website called Deep Groove Mono, which I highly recommend people, particularly those interested in Rudy Van Gelder. He's got discographies, and he's even started part of a campaign to keep the Englecliff studio, get it registered as a building of historic interest so it can be protected. And I learnt a lot about Rudy Van Gelder's methods from his webpage. We'd also like to thank Seth, our inaugural Patreon supporter. And if people would like to support us financially, it's a really easy way of doing it, and doesn't have to be an enormous amount of money each month, and you can cancel at any time. So if you wanted to just to make a one-off donation, you can still do that and then just literally cancel after the donation has been made. So, Nick, obviously I'd like to thank you for being my co-host here and going into lots of detail with discussions and solos and taking down solos, and also finding out information which I hadn't been able to find out. And hopefully people have enjoyed the fact that we're both coming at it from very slightly different angles, but with the same basic skill set.
Mm. Well, likewise. I mean, it's been really nice to discuss Sonny Clark, you know, one of my sort of favourite players, with somebody else who's obviously, you know, got a respect for him, and I've learnt a lot from you as well. So thanks, Simon.
Well, that's the end of series one, and we will be back with you in August talking about another pianist in 251. Two pianists, five podcasts, one subject, and you can have a hand in selecting that subject out of the three that were mentioned earlier. Thank you very much for listening. From me, Simon Whiteside, goodbye.
And from me, Nick Tomlin, goodbye.